gold on my shoulder. As I'm getting older, your people get colder. Most of us only care about money making. Selfishness got us following the wrong direction. Wrong information always shown by the media. Negative images is the main criteria. Infecting the young minds faster than bacteria. Kids wanna act like what they see in the cinema. Yeah. Whatever happened to the values of humanity? Whatever happened to the fairness and equality? Instead of spreading love, we're spreading animosity. Lack of understanding leading us away from unity. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling under. That's the reason why sometimes I'm feeling down. It's no wonder why sometimes I'm feeling under. Gotta keep my faith alive and love is found.
Good evening and welcome to All Things Reconsidered. I am your host and my name is Bruce Birch. Tonight we've got a couple of interviews to bring to you. One in particular from our good friend Steady from Ojai, California. We also have another one from an anti-war activist who did some demonstrations and some marching way back when in the day with Vietnam and some other issues that he was interested in. And, of course, a few of the stories that are hitting the top of the news today and yesterday and the day before. So stay tuned, sit back, relax, and enjoy. This is another edition of All Things Reconsidered. Good evening, this is Bruce Birch, and you are listening to All Things Reconsidered. I do have a little bit of a cold this evening, so if I sound a little rough, a little hoarse, a little, green around the gills, it's because I do have a cold. So just try to listen in, and maybe we can keep that from becoming too much of a problem while I'm broadcasting. There's been a number of things that happened this week, as there are every week. In particular, we've had a couple of weeks since the disaster down in New Orleans, and we've been able to correct, or should say, look back on that with some hindsight now. And the president and a number of the other people have been talking about, don't play the blame game, don't do this, don't do that, and I got to tell you, the people who often come to you and say, don't play the blame game, are the same people who themselves are guilty. So keep that in mind. If someone says, we don't want to play the blame game, well, they've kind of dropped that a little bit. They've kind of realized how ridiculous that sounds and how stupid they look when they say that. But, pay attention to that. That's going to be the buzzword. The don't play the blame game. Another one would be, the phrase Monday, Monday morning quarterbacking and, you know, all this stuff where they're, you know, they don't want you to look back and criticize, because if you did, you know, you would see some truth. You know, I've picked out a number of articles this week that I think are really important to bring to your attention as a listener of All Things Reconsidered. And one of those articles is from The Nation magazine. And if you know, I'm not being paid by The Nation to tell you this, but you know, if you want to get cutting edge news and analysis, this is the magazine to go to. Anyway, this particular article was written by a guy named John Elliston, who is actually from here in North Carolina. He's the news editor for the Asheville, North Carolina Mountain Express, and is also the author of Disaster in the Making, an investigative report on FEMA, which was funded by the Association of Alternative News Weeklies. This particular article is entitled The Confederacy of Dunces. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but there's also a book by that same name, and the author of that book escapes me at this point. But this particular article, it really, really wrapped up a lot of what the problem we saw. In a week full of evidence that the federal government is woefully unprepared to respond to natural disasters, the plaintive testimony of Aaron Broussard, the president of Jefferson Parish, just outside of New Orleans, stood out. "We have been abandoned by our own country," he told NBC's Meet the Press. Broussard recounted how local officials had been told every single day, "The cavalry is coming, the cavalry is coming, the cavalry is coming." "The cavalry's not here yet," he said. "I've begun to hear the hoofs, but we're almost a week out." You know, and one, just let me interject something here very quickly. One of the things that we have seen also is that the right-wing propaganda machine has been churning overtime to try to reshape the history of this event. Okay? Now, I'm not going to spend the entire night on Katrina, but I think it's very important to as activists and as people who are out there every day, to not allow this to happen. And how we can do that is by going to newspaper websites. A lot of them have, especially here in North Carolina and in other places, they have blogs where you can go in and refute some of the things that, you know, are being, or you can discuss certain articles. Here in Greensboro, North Carolina, where I am from, they have a newspaper called the News and Record. And in that News and Record, which is at news-record.com, they have letters to the editor. You can actually go in and comment on the letters to the editor. Now, the spin machine is saying, here's the spin machine. Number one, blame the mayor. Number two, blame the governor of the state. You know, say that they didn't do everything they were supposed to do. And number three, you know, obviously deflect everything you can from FEMA and from the President of the United States, who actually was given control of the situation on Saturday prior to the hurricane. You know, what we're seeing in this at this point is an aftermath. You know, it's very similar to what happened in Hurricane Andrew, which killed 23 people and exposed deep weaknesses in the federal emergency programs. You know, the emergency manager of Dade County, Florida, famously pleaded several days after Hurricane Andrew, "Where the hell is the cavalry?" Sound familiar? After Andrew, the cavalry got its act together. And, you know, actually under President Clinton's FEMA, the director, who was James Lee Witt, he won bipartisan praise throughout the 90s, by the way, that he ran that agency. Now, in 2002, FEMA was swallowed by the Department of Homeland Security, a move that the agency's current director, Michael Brown, promised would give the country a new, improved FEMA on steroids. Oh, boy. FEMA on, you know, on Quaaludes, perhaps. Instead, much of the agency's natural disaster work was sidelined in favor of anti-terrorism programs. And I quote, "I am extremely concerned that the ability of our nation to prepare for and respond to disasters has been sharply eroded." And that's a quote by James Lee Witt, in which he told Congress in a hearing on March the 24th of 2004. The former director has urged that the agency be withdrawn from the DHS, a proposal that is gaining traction in Congress following the Katrina meltdown. And, you know, let me tell you, how could they not want to withdraw this agency from DHS, from the Department of Homeland Security? At this point, you know, there's got to be something to happen. While the administration's push to privatize key services was draining the agency of some of its of some of its most experienced personnel, Bush appointed two FEMA directors with no substantive experience in disaster management. Joe Albaugh, who is Bush's chief of staff in Texas, was the first FEMA director, and his hand-picked successor, Michael Brown, was an official with the International Arabian Horse Association before coming to FEMA. One might say that this entire situation, if it were any sadder, you know, would be a Shakespearean tragedy. And that's not the worst of it. From its first months in office, the Bush administration has chipped away at disaster mitigation programs designed precisely to curb the kind of damage now overwhelming Louisiana and neighboring states. Project Impact, a modest but influential mitigation program created by Witt in 1997, had spread to around 250 communities in all 50 states before it got the Bush Budget Acts in 2001. And, you know, following that line of reasoning, this is me commenting on this, but following that line of reasoning, it would make sense that to say this. Anything that was perceived as successful under any previous Democratic administration has been seen as detrimental to the Republican administration. So what we're seeing is, in that respect, a lot of the programs that were in place under Bill Clinton that were successful, Bush is cutting them out. In 2003, Congress approved a White House proposal to slash in half FEMA's Hazard Mitigation Grant Program, which was credited with saving an estimated $8.8 million in recovery costs in 1999 in three eastern North Carolina communities after Hurricane Floyd. That same year, the Bush administration instituted a new program of mitigation grants awarded on a competitive basis. Again, the experts warned against this approach, saying that less affluent and smaller communities would lose out on desperately needed funds. And guess what? One of those communities was Jefferson Parish. Last year, FEMA turned down all three of its requests for flood mitigation grants. At the time, Broussard's Parish was home to more than 5,700 repetitive loss structures, buildings that had seen repeated flood damage and needed to be moved or elevated. That missed opportunity in Jefferson Parish is one of many in a region that FEMA must now reckon with. It's all too easy to play Monday morning quarterback amid the vast suffering along the Gulf Coast, but it's become all the more difficult to ignore the evidence that FEMA's ability to keep our country safe in the face of natural calamities, undermined by our commander-in-chief, is itself becoming a disaster. And you know, I wanted to bring that story to your attention mainly for a couple of reasons. The first one being, we cannot lose sight that we are absolutely capable of having government that does that works for us and does good things for us. I've been hearing time after time after time after time this week and in the week prior how, especially this morning I listened to Open Line with Ike Newkirk, which is out of Atlanta, Georgia, and caller after caller after caller to his show said the government is inept. The government is inept. The president is incompetent. You know, and he very well may be incompetent, but I believe he's incompetent, perhaps not naturally, but rather by design. The failure of this government to protect us and to protect the Gulf Coast, I believe, was by design. If we create a government that is inept, the people will turn away from it, and then the neocon agenda of privatization can then take hold. Some of the things that we've also that I've also looked at this week was some of the economics, the impact of what happened in with Hurricane Katrina. And following that line, we have an interview that I'm going to run now that is with myself and Steady from Ojai, California. We talk about a lot of things in this interview. If you know Steady, you know that we tend to get off track sometimes, but regardless, this primarily is about the economics of what's been going on over the last couple of weeks. And so give it a listen.
All right. I've got Steady on the line with me from Ojai, California. Steady, you are a regular to the show, and this week has, you know, we're seeing the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, and we're seeing it in a lot of different ways, but I understand you wanted to talk a little bit about the economic side of that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'll focus more on post-Katrina, but, we, you know, some of the stuff carries over that because, obviously, engineering wise of certain things are, you know, for specifically just to open it up, the levees, they have a certain engineering life when they're built, and there's been appropriations made or at least suggested to be made for the system in there, and that's not really what's in question, but then those funds, again, have been redirected, and the levees were also at the, you know, coming to the end of their engineering life, so we needed to do something. That's something that's pre-Katrina, that's an economic thing, a hard infrastructure question. But I want to talk about inflation and commodities and things that, you know, people need to live on, like food and fuel in our society.
Sure.
And money.
Okay.
Let's just take our dollar. Our dollar's been losing its value. And I mentioned in our second show that, you know, there was a conference to talk about the depreciating value of the dollar and United States credit worthiness by way of the dollar. That's still a very big issue. The treasuries we discussed at that time are still in question, and people are wondering how they're going to get paid back. But that's a completely different – that's an obligation that our government has to other nations and people who bought those treasuries. But in regards to commodities, that's a whole different market. You have the metals. I'm an electrician, so in copper I've seen an increase of 200%. It's doubled in 2 years.
Really? What's the cost of – Hey, I'm going to throw this out there because I used to be an electrician also.
Oh, really?
So I can relate to the price of copper. When I was doing electric work, and this is probably not going to, nobody else listening to this besides you and me are going to give a damn about this, but the price of a 250-foot roll of 12-2 copper Romex wire was about $20.
Okay.
How much is it now?
Well, it's still really not that much at the moment. It's about $25-$30.
Okay. It's gone up about $10 in about 3 years.
Now let's talk about 12-3 because they don't make as much of that and it goes off the shelves much faster.
Sure.
And 16 months ago, it was all gone and they were actually having to use the copper. That's it. It just come in, you know, they buy. It's like new copper. They didn't have any stuff that was already produced on the shelf, the old copper.
Okay.
And a roll of 250 feet of 12-3 was $63.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so the difference between 12-3 and 12-2 is only one number 12 wire.
Exactly.
And that's 250 feet.
Exactly.
Those spools go for, in different types of installations for $25, but now that's also a $30 roll. But let's go on into the monetary increments let me finish with steel because back at that time when that spike was in the metals, nails, screws, studs, steel stuff, joists, you know, post to beam clamps, you name it, iron, cold rolled steel for industry, all that stuff had already doubled. And it was such an accelerating rate where guys were bidding their jobs and the inflation was going up so much that the numbers that they put into the bids, by the time they actually had to buy the materials, they were better off paying the fine and walking away from the job and starting because they were going to eat it because the inflation ate up their profit in steel, in aluminum, in copper. The guys were just walking away from jobs because they just paid the fines and walked away, and they put it out for rebid.
So the economics of that, okay. Well, how long ago was that?
That was, I would say, in a 12 to 16 month window past. Prior to Katrina.
Okay.
But since Katrina now, we haven't seen the surge in the oil price that many were expecting, but the talking heads are just, you know, $100, $125 barrel oil is totally realistic with the things that we see on the horizon. It's kind of like the war drum that was being beat before we went to Iraq. They're priming the population to get ready for that. And, you know, the United States can regulate these people and keep them in their proper spheres. The cost of natural gas, is specifically in the Northeast Corridor,
right,
is this winter going to be something that's critical in affecting almost 40% of the customers who heat their homes and use gas, natural gas, in the region because they have not increased the gas pipeline infrastructure. They made a decision in 1996 in what to do to support their newly deregulated market, and they decided we can make twice as much money by running half the capacity. And that,
of course.
That's the model. That's corporate thinking. I mean, and I haven't actually got to hear the last interview, Zappa. I'm not sure if that's up again.
Yeah, it is. It's been re-uploaded. So.
Oh, cool. Then I'll get to listen to that. but at right after the Katrina thing, you know, we were all expecting the oil surge, and we actually saw the drop in the oil this week. And I know I'm not an economist, and I'm not a market guy. Actually, when we moved into Iraq, we pulled all our money out of the markets because it's that volatile. It's that type of time right now. But that's not to be an alarmist. That's just I'm in the gold and silver coin.
Sure.
I'm a you know, constitutionalist or federalist in that regard.
Okay.
That's what many of the founding fathers knew about paper money. So we're going back into the post-Katrina inflation in our currencies and our credits and people's debt, and people are talking about housing bubble. Well, here you have a situation in New Orleans where 100,000 homes are lost, and insurance companies really can't even absorb that. There's no way that they can absorb that. And on top of that, this week people might be familiar with some of the headlines that Delta and Northwest Airlines have collapsed. Now they're trying to blame the situation on the loss of traffic in that region, but they've been financing long-term debt on short-term notes for a long time.
Right.
And I remember the headlines in Los Angeles Times on September 11th said the airlines are in trouble, but they tried to blame a lot of the problems post 911 on the 911 incident itself. But you know, in the Times we saw on the day of the attacks, that was not the cause. It was already evident that they were struggling.
Sure.
And the same with Ford and GM, but that goes back again before Katrina. All the implications.
Oh, that goes way back to Reagan and Lee Iacocca.
Yeah, Reagan and his deregulation again of our national, you know, air traffic system. You know, we just had our anniversary of 911, 4-year anniversary. There's another documentary that's out people might be familiar with. I mentioned Power Hour with the Beyond Treason, but they're doing David von Kleist did one called 911 in Plain Sight, and they covered everything from the Pentagon to the World Trade Center to the Able Danger and, something Guardian, air operation war games that were going on in the Northeast, where there were 22 potential bogeys in the sky or hijacked aircraft as drills, so the people couldn't really actually identify which craft was the actually hijacked aircraft. You know, that type of thing is coming out now. And I pointed out a few anomalies that they presented and gave them my own scenarios. We can talk about that after. I don't want to take too much time with that, but he was definitely interested and gave me a release to show the thing publicly, you know, because I talked to him. Glad you're on our side. I was in the Navy. I'm familiar with all the things that you can strap on an airplane.
Sure.
How you have to maintain your navigation. And if you see the video, either from CNN documentary or the Nade brothers or this 911 in plain sight, you'll see the anomalies of flash as this plane hits the impact, and there's something strapped to the bottom of the airplane. This is footage from, CNN.
Okay, so
public access stuff.
Well, and I don't want to get too far off into that, but just as a quick answer, what do you think it was?
Oh, well, you have to go totally conspiracy-file on that to accept my theory. But if you agree that the plane was not the flight American Airlines or the flight with the passengers on it, it was a uranium something on the front in the nose cone of the airplane where normally the navigation and radar sit, and it to do the most damage when it impacts the towers and hopefully take it out structurally. But as I mentioned before, when we talked about the depleted uranium, that material has an interstellar voltage of 4.5 million volts, electron volts. So when it smashes into something at 500 miles an hour, you're going to get like a shock, like you grounded out a circuit, a flash of light. That's exactly what that is. And now, because the depleted uranium's in the nose cone, were normally the navigation and radar and, you know, controlling mechanism sit, that had to be strapped under the belly of the airplane. You couldn't have your communications. I mean, they only want to use cell phones on a line, on an airplane, right? So you've got 100 pounds of depleted uranium up front and over your radar equipment. You got to strap that to the bottom of the airplane so it doesn't interfere with the communication.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, we have to, you know, we may have to do a special show at some point on just the various theories that there are out there, and that's as probably as logical one as any other one that I've heard at this point.
Yeah, people can surf by that, the Power Hour.
Okay.
Beyond Treason, and there's one, www.letsroll911.
Uh-huh.
And that's the guy webmaster for that site, actually just took the footage that was out there on the shelf and slowed it down, and he's the one who presented this to the Power Hour.
Oh, cool. Well,
there's another one that I don't think is up anymore, but it's called Hunt the Boeing.
Okay. Well, that's, you know, sliding forward 4 years to...
Right. Back up to today, huh?
To Katrina. You know, you had mentioned something right before we went on to the recording of this interview. You had mentioned something about the rising cost of gold. Okay, now, you know, I understand that gold goes, you know, and also you're talking about shipping lanes down in the south. What kind of impact are we going to see in a real sense? Let's say you're talking to someone who's never, who's not an economics major, who has never really looked at this stuff in depth. Break it down in simple terms for a guy like me.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, I myself too. I do tend to overcomplicate things, but in a nutshell, honest money is usually based on something that's not easily manipulated.
Okay.
We used to do that, and it's actually in our Constitution that gold and silver coin is the only means of transaction or our lawful account of currency or something like that, lawful money of account.
Okay.
So the price since 1970, which I think it was at $40, you know, today is at $400, so you have a 1,000% increase of your monetary units. Now, what that actually is almost a 1,000% decrease in the purchasing value of your dollar. Now, how have we been able to do that when you can walk into Walmart and buy, you know, a set of towels, which are, you know, maybe not the best quality, but you can, you know, get a set of towels for $7-$8. How do you do that? You steal from the country or wherever that's making by cheap labor, and you make the dollar appear like it's buying more, but it's really not. So going back to the dollar and honest money, a silver dollar in 1900 was worth a dollar.
Okay.
If today, if it's in decent condition, it's worth about $70. Just a regular old Morgan dollar.
Okay.
So what I'm presenting is that is how for many decades, even centuries, that was what our money was based up right up until 1970. And in 1970, we took the dollar off the Franklin Roosevelt system and went to a floating exchange rate. And that came from Kissinger and George Shultz.
So basically off the gold standard is what you're saying.
Okay, now, yes, gold reserve standard.
Okay.
Which was the Bretton Woods monetary system.
Sure.
And it's how we rebuilt Europe after World War II with fixed exchange rates so you can finance long, you know, development projects, infrastructure projects, without the money-grubbing bankers making a killing, you know, being able to fluctuate and interest only with their creative loan stuff that they're coming up with now. It was fixed. The bankers can charge certain fees for their services, and the percentage was reasonable. And when you put these type of projects in motion over time, like, say, a light rail system coming out of New Orleans now, in 25 years, you build the thing in 3 years. In 25 years, it will have paid for itself.
Sure.
And that's how you finance it, over 1% to 2%. And you can only do that if you have fixed prices.
Okay.
You can't have a 21-cent jump in silver in one day like we had today. You can't see Northwest Airlines and Delta Airlines stock values drop 18% to 30% in one day. It's fixed. China's on that.
Okay. But to be realistic, the changes that happened, that occurred in one day today, are not always changes that stay that way. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
They fluctuate, and they deem that to be market forces of supply and demand.
Okay.
But they control the market. It's their market. everyone, and going back to the how it affects, how it relates to people, if they're holding any type of paper, whether it's, you know, whether it's Amgen or it's Yahoo,
uh-huh.
eBay, or Federal Reserve notes, as the credit worthiness of the dollar goes down, interest rates go up.
Okay.
As the interest rates go up, people who are in these creative, let's say mortgage situations, bear the brunt of covering those costs. As we continue to shut down jobs and move towards the service industry, the little money that is still available for the masses of the population becomes less and less scarce, and you have less money in circulation per capita, and it's buying less, and it's also you got that interest rate if you on top of that, and then other commodities, the price is going up. Like I might have repeated myself in that system there,
yeah.
But you have what do they call that? A multiplying or magnitudes building upon each other in an accelerating collapse function. The income's disappearing. You're buying less. We're familiar with this in our country. Washington, in the beginning, when they went to paper money, said a wagon load of provisions will scarcely buy a wagon load of provisions. And I think Jefferson said if the American people ever allow bankers to control their currency, control and issue their currency, their children will wake up homeless on the continent that their forefathers conquered. They knew the evils of paper and how the bankers can, you know, they own the earth.
Sure.
Take it away from them and give them the power to issue currency of the United States, and then with a flick of a pen, they'll buy it back. And that's not Ron Quigley, Carol Quigley, who was Clinton's mentor. That's a Georgetown University professor. I've memorized some of these things because they stick with me, and I hunt from there under the basis of that, and that premise, that someone of that caliber would make a statement like that.
Sure.
And I go from there. And how far does the rabbit hole go?
Well, and unfortunately, we can't follow the rabbit hole all the way down tonight.
Not tonight. Darn. Ron and I, we could have all weekend.
There you go. But what we can do is we can lay the groundwork for the next episode.
Okay.
And perhaps maybe that could be the next topic if you're interested in doing that.
Sounds good.
Okay.
I'll have a good time this week because I'll have two of your shows. And honestly, I listen to Tom quite a bit now. I was doing a lot of stuff before, but I've listened a lot to your show. I'm growing in the interviews as well. I want to say what I want to say. It's a development process. It's like being on camera. I'm not one who's in screen or acting, but as you go through and listen to yourself on that, you get kind of a unit. Did I say that? Or how did I say that? Or what did he say?
It's
the whole process of growing. You know, someone like Tom who sits in that seat, they're pros. They've been doing it for a while. He's on 4 or 5 hours, 6 hours a day.
Yeah, 6 hours a day.
That's huge.
That is incredible. And you know, well, I certainly hope that this show can grow and we can keep the energy up and keep it moving, because the only way that we're going to be able to take back this country is through the citizens' core. And we are citizens.
I agree.
Absolutely. Well, listen, you have a wonderful evening, and it's great to talk with you.
You do the same.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. I've got Steady on the line with me.
And that was an interview with Steady from Ojai, California, one of our favorite guests that we guys that we interview. Has a wealth of information to share every show. Very well-read individual. We're going to be shifting focus a little bit and moving away from some of the Katrina economic stuff and on to an event that is going to be coming up in a week, or less than a week at this point. On the September the 24th, there will be a march on Washington, which is an End the War on Iraq march on Washington. This is sponsored by United for Peace and Justice, and you can go online at www.unitedforpeace.org. and find out everything you could possibly want to find out. On their webpage, they have updates. They can sign up for email updates. They even have a housing board, transportation board. You name it, it is there. So if you are interested in going to this march, please do. Please do go. Now, and the reason why I'm saying please do go, I'm going to do a little bit of a rant here. You know, we have a number of people in our country who are dissatisfied with the current administration, extremely dissatisfied with the current administration. You know, it's behooven upon us to make sure that we do everything we can, and not necessarily to get them out of office, but at least to express our displeasure. Because there are other people who make decisions in this country besides the President of the United States. Some of those people are our congressmen, our senators, you know, even down to our Board of Commissioners, or aldermen, or city council, and or parish council, wherever you may be. If we don't express our displeasure, they will take our being quiet as assent, meaning that we agree with what they're doing. By not saying anything, they think that we agree that with what they're doing. Back in the 60s, there was a considerable peace movement. There was a considerable movement that went out and expressed displeasure with the way the war was going, with the way the country was being run, etc. There was racial injustice marches. There were just a plethora of issues that people went out and marched against and expressed their displeasure, expressed their constitutional right to free speech, to dissent. Well, now is the time that we do it for the 21st century, and the reason why I say that is because at this point, you know, this government is not going to, I'm going to just point blank, let's just call it what it is. This government and its current occupant at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue hates America. Wow, that's a strong way to put that. They hate America. Why do I say they hate America? Because they're undoing what has worked in America for the last 70 years. They're undoing what has worked in America for the last 70 years. They're removing Medicaid, Medicare. They're trying to dismantle Social Security. They are trying to privatize all of those things that government has done well, for the most part, under Democratic presidents. They're trying to remove all those things that have worked in government for the people of the United States. And what they're replacing it with are people like Michael Brown, are people like Michael Chertoff, who have no idea in the world what they're doing. Donald Rumsfeld. And it can get depressing, you know, for a number of us, but we have to keep our chin up. You know, and the way that I'm doing that is by proactive work. So I'm going to D.C. I'm going to go to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to be a part of that march, and I'm going to have my input known. I'm going to do my best to not get arrested or have something happen to me. But I am going to go, and I am going to express my constitutional right to free speech. The next interview that we have coming up is actually with a veteran anti-war protester who is from the same city that I'm in, and you know, I decided to do this interview with him because I thought it would be apropos for where we are today and what we're about to embark upon next weekend. So without any further ado, this next interview is with Kent from Greensboro, North Carolina.
All right, I'm on the line right now with Kent from Greensboro, North Carolina, and Kent is a veteran of anti-war demonstrations across the South and actually some up north. Is that right, Kent?
Yes.
Okay. Well, how many demonstrations did you attend? Do you remember?
Well, I actually have not sat down and counted them, but I would say if you combine the large ones and the small ones, probably somewhere around 30.
30. Wow. Now, you know, just speaking from a strictly Southern perspective, how many do you think, now, we're talking about the 60s, correct?
Mostly.
Okay.
There you know, that was the time of my greatest activity, but there have been a few since.
Okay. How many, for instance, have you, you know, how many were in Greensboro, for instance, during the 60s? Now, this is a, sort of a hotbed of the South, but...
Probably 10 to 12 in Greensboro.
Okay.
And that involves several different issues. Demonstrations against the war in Vietnam, but also a couple of civil rights demonstrations.
Okay.
Later ones, really. But there were several.
Now, have you... In the years since then, have you been, equally as participatory, or are you doing things in a different way now?
To a large extent, I'd say I'm less active in attending large demonstrations. I've become more local in my focus and my politics. I'm still interested in the national stuff, but due to just lifestyle changes and things, I find it more difficult to attend large demonstrations and keep my life in some semblance of order.
Which, do you remember the first demonstration that you attended, and do you remember the possibility of what year that might have been?
The first demonstration that I remember was probably 1968, and it would have been a peace vigil at the Federal Building in Greensboro.
Okay.
Some of the friends sponsored a weekly peace vigil there. And actually, I guess if you considered that on a weekly basis instead of as one continuing demonstration, there were probably 30 or 40 of those that I attended.
Wow.
But I just kind of think of that in terms of being one continuing demonstration.
What was the mood then? I mean, if you could compare the mood among progressives at that time to the mood among progressives at this time, was there a big difference, or is it fairly the same?
I think my perspective was perhaps more narrow at the time.
Okay.
The people I was associating with were much more involved in the anti-war movement, civil rights movement, the women's movement, and so it was much more heavily focused, and the people that I was around were much more active.
Okay.
Today I find that to a large extent people are much more withdrawn, even timid, about stating what they feel if it seems to not be of the mainstream.
Yeah. Well, I can't help but think that the media has been complicit in some of that, mainly because, not to get off track here, but just that the president and his cohorts, for the first 3 or 4 years only gave, two press conferences? So that sort of has trickled down. At least it seems to have trickled down to the rest of us, in which, we are being kowtowed into keeping our mouths closed. And but I think the tide is turning in that area. Wouldn't you agree?
I'm hoping so. I find that more people are starting to speak out against problems they see. Whether it be in Iraq or constitutional rights. Or individual rights, for that matter.
Okay. Well, getting back to the subject of the demonstrations, what would you tell someone? Let's say you're talking to someone who's in their 20s and is going to a demonstration for the first time ever. What would you tell them to be a piece of advice?
keep your eyes open. You know, the I think back to when I first got started being politically active and being publicly vocal. There was a considerable amount of resistance in the South, especially, you know, here in Greensboro. The first peace march, not to be that we really had, not to be confused with the peace vigil, probably had about 100 people in it, and you know, people were very offended by the fact that there were people who disagreed with the war in Vietnam right here in little old Greensboro. But if you know, when I look at that, I'm glad that you know, that I took a stand and that I did publicly state by my presence what I believed in.
Sure.
So, you know, stand up and be counted.
Dissent is patriotic.
Hmm?
Dissent is patriotic.
Sounds like a Thomas Jefferson quote.
So what you're saying is basically watch your back, you know, go into the situation with eyes wide open and understand that once you put yourself out there, you know,
there is some risk.
There is some unpredictability about it.
Yeah. You know, I have found that really there are very few people, especially in the peace demonstrations, who really had much risk of physical harm. Now, there were a few people who sought out the opportunity for physical confrontation. but for the large extent, you know, it was peaceful, and, you know, in a few occasions, there was a physical confrontation. I remember during mobilization in D.C., you know, almost getting run over by a police motorcycle. But that really was just about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they were trying to, I guess you'd say, herd the crowd. And, you know, there were several instances where tear gas was used in different demonstrations. But, you know, usually these were things that happened to people who were seeking, as I said, you know, a physical confrontation. They did not happen to most of the people who were there. They may have seen it, but they did not participate.
Okay. Okay. Well, let's do this then. We have about five and a half minutes left or so. If you were to do a checklist of the items that a person might need to take with them, what would that checklist look like?
I think just for personal comfort, probably some tissues, a couple of snack bars, maybe a bottle of water or canteen, something like that. You know, it's hard to say what is going to be available. You know, those with medical problems would need to probably address that in a rational manner.
Just to interject something really quickly before you go on, if you do have medical problems, whatever medication you have needs to be in the original bottle, because apparently, from what I understand, if the medication is not in the original bottle, or if you don't have a copy of the prescription with you, they can confiscate it and arrest you. So keep that in mind.
Okay.
That's just some new information that came across that I figured I would pass along.
Well, that, you know, it sounds reasonable, and, you know, if they're seeking ways to remove people from the crowd, that might be one.
Mm-hmm. Especially the geriatrics, right?
Whatever. If someone were seeking more physical confrontation, you know, heavy clothing, although the temperature is going to be a factor there, and for most of us, me included, you know, just good walking shoes, probably long pants, and, you know, a shirt to reflect whatever the weather is like.
And the current political administration?
Well, you know, there maybe bulletproof vests would be a good thing. But, well, that was Kent State, wasn't it?
Yeah. That only happens in Ohio.
And a few other places.
Right.
But, you know, it's... it really, you know, tends to be the exception.
Okay.
I feel like most of the police on the street really are basically just doing a job. They may or may not agree with us, but it's not their place to voice it, and most of them don't. But there are those who would seek confrontation, just like there's some in the demonstrations who would.
Sure. So, just to, you know, just to sort of recap that, it's good to take bottled water. If you have your medications with you, make sure you have a prescription for them. What about electronic equipment?
Well, for memory's sake, and perhaps for evidence's sake, depending on the situation, cameras, small tape recorders, you know, it can provide a lot of memories. You know, now, 30 years later, or close to it, or 40 years later, really.
Yeah.
You know, some of my my memories of those times are recorded, and you know, be it photographs or whatever.
Okay.
And you know, it's part of history, my part.
Okay. Well, I do understand. It's come to my attention that there is a concerted effort organizing to oppose the anti-war demonstrators. If you know, let's just say, for instance, I'm sure at some point throughout all of those rallies and demonstrations you went to that you ran across situations where you had counter-demonstrators. What do you do in those situations?
Generally, the best thing to do is keep your cool and keep moving. Take a note from Gandhi in that respect.
Spoken like a true statesman.
And... you know, you don't have to fall into a trap, and to a large extent, a lot of times those confrontations, that's what they want.
Okay. Is they want to disrupt the march and create enough havoc to shut it down? Is that what you're saying?
Possibly.
Okay.
If nothing else, just to make it look like you know, it's not a responsible political demonstration.
Okay. Well, Kent, you know, I really appreciate that you took the time to sit down and talk with us, and now Kent and I are going to be traveling together up to D.C. for this demonstration. And Kent, I really appreciate it, and we'll do this again sometime real soon.
Okay, Bruce.
Okay, thanks a lot, man.
Okay, good night.
Good night.
Run like pigs from the
And that was a wonderful, wonderful song. Yes, I am the maggot. That was about 12th harmonic. And you can reach that song as well as a number of other wonderful pieces and literary pieces online at at 12thharmonic.com, I believe it is. That was used by permission. I actually asked him, and they were like, they were fantastic with that. And actually, you know, he's from Australia. That site is an Australian-based site, and they're having the same problems with their government as we're having with ours. So maybe we should unite in solidarity and try to help each other out with this stuff. I wanted to bring to your attention something before we sign off here, and this is in conjunction with or sort of happening at the same time as the March on Washington to end the war in Iraq, and this is called the Green Festival, which will be in Washington at the Washington Convention Center on September the 24th and 25th. There will be 350 exhibits, including Green Careers and Education, Green Finances, Eco Fashion, Natural Health and Body, Green Media, Community Action, Green Technology, Natural Home and Garden, Deep Ecology, Green Business Practices, Fair Trade, Renewable Energy, Conservation, Recycling, Indigenous Goods, Organic Food, Agriculture, Natural Foods, and a Conversation Cafe. And they will also have speakers, including Amy Goodman from Democracy Now!, Jim Hightower, we all know who Jim is, Greg Palast, Van Jones, Hazel Henderson, and Medea Benjamin from Code Pink. So if you're going to be going to D.C. also for the wonderful, wonderful march to end the illegal occupation of Iraq, please do stop into this festival, which will be in the Washington Convention Center. This also, just so you know, will be in San Francisco, California, on November the 5th and 6th. And finally, as we wrap this show up for this week, I just want to tell you that I know one thing for sure, and when it comes to protests, size does matter. When it comes to protests, size does matter. So keep that in mind, you know. Get ready. Pack up your car. Take a leave of absence. Take Friday off from work and drive down to D.C. Do what you can do. Go to your local, be a part of your local peace coalition. Anything that we can do to try to bring some sense back into what we know as the United States of America can help. And with that, my friends, thanks for listening. You've been listening to All Things Reconsidered. All Things Reconsidered is broadcast or netcast every Sunday evening from 10 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and Eastern Daylight Time, depending on however the government wishes to run it for the moment. You can reach us online at www.thetruthis.us/ATR. You can also drop us an email if you choose to do so. We welcome those, any comments on our show, at ATR_Bruce@yahoo.com. Thanks for listening and have a great week.
Republican, and so I was actually losing affiliates. I mean, there was one station out in Santa Cruz, California, where the owner actually got on the air and apologized for having me on their station. And I was, and well, let me put it this way before, you know, some of you are thinking, well, I don't blame them. But I'm not saying anything differently now than you read in the daily newspaper editorials, or you hear on The Daily Show, or what's his name, Marr, why can't I think of his first name? Bill? Yeah, Bill. I've never even seen that program. You know, I mean, I know I'm so weird. Jay Hudson, our producer, also.